But now I realize, since I saw you smile, there's only happiness for me. So bye-bye blues.
And we need to fade down, as they say, and end the Big Band Broadway and Beyond show. Thank you very much, Joe, for a very, very entertaining 3 hours. Cabaret is one of my personal favorites of the classic Broadway musicals. It is 101 right now at WHFR Dearborn, and this is the station making waves, and one of the ways we do that is with very special program you can't hear anywhere else on your dial. Coming up for the next hour is the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. My name is Jay Koronek. Thank you for being with us today. We cover news that other people don't and talk to important people in our area. I'm joined in the studio by our WHFR news director, Amy Powers, as well as Dennis Reimars, our WHFR reporter and also promotion coordinator. Congratulations to both of you for being reappointed to your positions for the fall semester.
Seriously?
Thank you
very much.
Volunteers who get no pay need to at least be congratulated every now and then.
Everyone else stepped backward.
I did that. Yeah. Oh, that old trick.
Yeah, we had to have somebody there, you know.
Thanks, Jay.
But you know how to do it and do it well. And with us in the studio joining us today is one of those special guests, people that really know a lot more than we do and are on the front lines of local public service and getting things done and for the better in Dearborn. This is Dave Norwood, who is with us today, who is the Dearborn Sustainability Coordinator. Dave, welcome to the WHFR Journal.
Thank you, Jay.
We're interested to find out, first of all, for their listeners that haven't kept up in city government and who's who, tell us a little bit about your background and your tenure with the city, and then we'll talk about the new position that you're in, and it's a new position for the city, too, of sustainability coordinator.
Thank you, Jay. I've been with the city since, I guess it's been 1992, when I was an intern in a legal department for a summer and became a law clerk for a couple years under former city attorney at the time was Bill Holkren, who's now a judge in the 19th District Court. And then from there, after I graduated from law school, I was appointed to the mayor's office under Mayor Guido to be a citizen liaison. And during that work, I worked on problems that citizens had and different trying to expedite some issues and be an ombudsman. And I work with neighborhood associations a lot. So we're trying to improve relationships with the city and different citizen groups. And that was my primary responsibility at that time. And then I was appointed to the position. I was in the building department. I was a director there for a while. And that's where my interest in green and sustainability really blossomed, because I have a biology degree. I'm an environmental lawyer. That's really my background, and I'm a UFM Dearborn grad, and I think everybody here should spend a summer on the Rouge, at least a few weeks.
You mean paddling up and down the Rouge? Or?
No, just I spent a summer in field biology with Dr. Oren Gelderloos.
Oh, yes. We've interviewed him here.
Mm-hmm. I'm a disciple of his. I spent had many classes with him. In Dearborn should spend some time down on the Rouge in the center.
He just recently moved back to, I think, teaching where he really was the person primarily the most instrumental in developing the University of Michigan Interpretive Center, that is the environmental studies facility for the public that hosts many student groups and from outside U of MD as well as U of MD students, and they have a nice building over there, and that's where the Sierra Club roundtable is going to be later this month that we'll talk about. But he very, very significant person in their biology department. Is that correct?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had field biology with him. I had biology 101, 102 with him, and then I had some independent studies with him. We were looking at actually elementary school books about science, how they teach the law of conservation, matter, and energy. A little esoteric, but if people understood that, we would understand the problems we're in right now. But so anyways, he was a great person, very large, strong influence in my life and why I went into what I went into. But during the time in the building department, I was part of the permitting process for the Ford F-150 plant. And when they brought about to us the plans of the city about the green roof, the pervious surface for the parking lot, it was a big challenge for the folks in the city to deal with these things because we never had seen these type of projects like that. So I got involved in the United States Green Building Council at that time, who was a supporting group to Ford Land, and I learned about these different techniques of building green. So that project was pretty successful and still is. There was recently a 5-year study done on that roof, and it's doing fabulous. It's performing and there's a little ecosystem that's blossoming on top of that roof now. Mm-hmm. Geese are nesting there, and it's a great project.
In many cities across the country, I'm not sure about Detroit, but there are apartment buildings and some corporate headquarters that have turned their roof into a small garden, at least planted grass or something, and it's a great insulator, and of course it takes that nasty carbon dioxide out of the air and recycles it. So anything you can do like that is desirable. And now, of course, there's a lot of regulations that demand that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's communities around the country. Chicago, you're going to build in Chicago, you're going to get a green roof. So what really I'm doing, working on now, my primary responsibility is the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, which was something that was passed in 2007 but was funded in 2009. Mm-hmm. And that opportunity the mayor said we need to have somebody really take on this grant and create the position of sustainability coordinator.
So we can make use of the money that's available to us for these appropriate projects.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned the case was, in Chicago, if you're going to build something new, it's going to have a green roof. What exactly does that mean?
Well, what Chicago did is they created a carrot and a stick approach. If you build green, you will get your permit in 15 days. If you don't, it takes you about nine months to get a permit.
And what does that mean? Is it, you know, I think green is, especially for building, you know, solar panels or, you know, radiant heat, something, you know, that, you know, in that direction.
Well, green covers a lot of areas. Mm-hmm. It covers your indoor air quality.
Okay.
How you handle your stormwater, mm-hmm. how you're located on your site, not just your energy, not just your electric getting from solar panels.
Okay.
But waterless urinals.
Okay.
There's some standards that are a little higher than some of the things in Chicago where you can't let any water leave your site.
And excuse me, I'm sorry. And let's face it, I mean, the carrot and the stick, and sometimes that's necessary because to do these things, it's a little bit more expensive. Like initially, mm-hmm. I know in the long run, it'll end up being cheaper and obviously
yes.
better.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes people need the incentive because they're looking short term.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Sometimes the upfront cost can be more. But if you look at a life cycle analysis,
absolutely.
We're in our house, our houses last 50 to 75 years. Think about how long, you know, what that impact is over that period of time.
Absolutely. And I think a big reason why we have some of the problems we have today is people weren't thinking long term enough.
Clearly.
I think that, no, obviously,
yeah,
right.
I agree.
It's fundamental.
Absolutely.
And I think that this gradual shift is, I don't know, people seem to be catching on, don't they?
Yeah, and it's also good business.
In spite of the small government rhetoric of Tea Partiers, whoever they are, and so on, I think big government, and I've said this a long time as an independent voter, is that certain problems need the best answers, and the best answers sometimes are government involvement. In this case, you have to have government that puts out the guidelines, not necessarily restrictions, but they are incentives, whether it's financial incentives or just making the businesses and the individual owners aware of the possibility. Certainly the construction trade, the contractors, they're sometimes behind a little bit in their skills, and they need retraining to get into these things too. And so what they would recommend easily is the older technology because that's what they know, that's what they've done well. But and they've heard about the newer technology, even if you're in the business, but you're not sure if you want to make the investment in time to get retrained and to deal with the new materials and learn the new materials. That takes time too. So there, the city just a matter of setting up the guidelines. And I know building safety was criticized for years of having too many strict and sometimes nonsensical guidelines. But in this case, it's guidelines that, as Dennis, you just said, that it's going to save energy, it's going to save their cost in the future, one way or the other. So I think government has got to do that. And, of course, we're talking about local government here, mm-hmm. not big-time federal government. Mm-hmm. But somebody has to do it, and hopefully those standards, of course, are somewhat consistent throughout the Detroit area or the state. I mean, Dave, you're aware of mm-hmm. whether federal guidelines and their state guidelines that we can refer to mm-hmm. here at least that give some consistency at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a movement afoot nationally about codes, about green building. The International Code Council is an organization that creates model codes. It's actually a combination of several code agencies over the years around the country. And they are now having public hearings on a green code, green building code. And once that – it takes about 18 months to go through the cycle because they have several public hearings, a series of them. And once that becomes a model code, you'll see states looking to adopt it. And in Michigan, we do look at the International Code Council for our building codes. Now, the state, we take and we do some tweaking to it and some things to meet the specific needs of Michigan. But it's a standard code throughout the state. So, Jay, your point is well taken. Mm-hmm. It would be great if it was agreeing across the state. So it would be fair to all the contractors across the state and people knew what to expect.
I'd like to take a step back. I did mention that this sustainability office that you're in for the city of Dearborn now, first of all, you're the first person to lead it. It was created because it was important, I think, but and you're the first person there. Where did the name sustainability come from? I think, you know, that's we've heard about ecology stuff, and the general public may not be quite clear of how the term sustainability is kicking in there, although if you look in a dictionary, it's kind of obvious, perhaps.
Yeah, sustainability, why it works in this particular case is, kind of shorthand definition is, you know, the things we do today don't hurt the things that people need to survive in the future. We don't jeopardize their needs by what we do today. So why it's key to why it works right now is with the Energy Block Grant dollars, those were specifically set aside to deal with energy and creating programs, policies, projects to save energy and be efficient with our resources today. Mm-hmm. So I think it works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other things I'm doing other than a block grant, but yes, that's right. my key function right now.
Yeah, I think it's a cautionary term too, because sustainability, to have an office that is working towards that, it should indicate to everybody listening everywhere that we can't continue the lifestyles that we have now in terms of energy use and even personal lifestyles of buying transportation, for example, automobiles that aren't using the most efficient kind of renewable energy resources. And I think people are starting to become aware of that, but a sustainability situation, it doesn't mean we want to sustain what we have going now, because our lifestyles right now are not sustainable in the future. There will be. I just found out the first person to talk about peak oil, that is, when the oil reserves of the world or the United States start to decline. I mean, when we're over the hump, perhaps now, finally, they mentioned this in 1956, and peak oil, I think most experts are saying we're right around the time now worldwide where the reserves, we might find some more, but they'll be much more expensive and we won't be able to afford it, just like digging in the Gulf Coast, you know, for oil. That's really expensive oil. The cost of getting that out from a mile down under the sea, if they can reliably do it, and the extra cost of paying for the cleanup afterwards, that's just, we're not going to be able to afford oil, whether it's 10 years, 20 years, 30 years away, for our cars, for our businesses. It's not going to be there. Just not, whether we're totally out of it is not the case. Can we afford it anymore? No, we won't be able to. And so other renewable energy sources like the sun and wind power for cars. All these cars with sails on top of them. solar
We've
sails.
We've got the clearance.
Anyway, it's going to be an exciting future, but we have to move to a culture that is able to be sustained, and even that even applies to our waste and trash and so on. That I know the Detroit area, I think most of the landfill is filled, you know, for dumping our regular bad trash, you know, not the recyclable stuff, because that goes to plants and gets crushed, and maybe some of it can be used for other things, but the basic trash that you just got to dump somewhere. We're definitely running out of the landfill space in Detroit, and of course it doesn't help that Toronto is sending us all their landfill trash. Mm-hmm. They're already out of space, or at least we're cheaper to send it, you know, 300 miles to us and dump it here. Are you involved in planning for that eventuality?
Sure.
At all? Your office coordinates, I assume, with several City of Dearborn offices.
Yes.
By the way, folks, we are talking with Dave Norwood of the City of Dearborn here.
Yes, I am working on dealing with our trash on two fronts. First is there's a new recycling program we have in town with the large bins and the single source recycling, where you put everything through one. You don't have to sort it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
Yes. And which goes out to the Great Lakes Recycling facility in like New Boston area. I visited the site. It's all modern facility that they sort all the trash, and there's markets for our recycled materials. On the other hand, trying to stop stuff going into landfill, divert things, work on another front. The mayor had a visit here in Dearborn from the King of Sweden, who came here to drive a Volvo on the test track, and the mayor was there to visit with the King of Sweden. Well, after the King of Sweden left Dearborn, he was going to Flint to visit I know it's odd, Flint.
Yeah.
Well, Flint was. I have to give Flint a lot of credit. They're a struggling community, but they're. I've talked to their sustainability person there, and they're giving it the good fight. They are using their sewage sludge to create methane to power their bus fleet, and the company that's doing it. It's a partnership with the city, and this company is Swedish Biogas.
Mm-hmm.
So the mayor got interested in this thing with our CSO projects, with the, on the trash we generate. He said, what if we do something like that here in Dearborn? So with our block grant dollars, our energy block grant dollars, we're doing a waste to energy feasibility study to look at all our waste streams, to keep it out of the landfill to create power.
Mayor Guido mentioned years ago on one of our talks with him, and I think now it's either not needed or just not appropriate somehow, or maybe the idea is still going. Mayor Guido thought of putting in turbines to actually produce energy, in other words, our own mini energy plants. And I don't know if it's just wind turbines or whether he was thinking of just using gasoline or coal in a more energy efficient way right here in the city. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't Wyandotte have some sort of energy generation plant going?
Yeah, Wyandotte is a unique community. They have their own utility system with their cable and their
They're like self-contained,
power.
Aren't they?
They are. Well, they've been around a long time. Wyandotte's a pretty old community. Sure. They're also looking at waste energy. They're also looking at a geothermal utility where it's not just individual business or house, where they would have a district-wide approach. So they're pretty unique, and I think that's something we're going to look at in Dearborn. A geo-utility potentially for certain campuses around. It'd be a great use for Ford land. Say they want to create a utility on Commerce Drive where they could heat and cool several buildings with that. But there's technology out there to tap potentially the Rouge River for using, not damming it, but there's
hydroelectric
that lay in the bottom of the river. I'm not sure we have the flow yet. The technology is caught up with
the
flow.
Sometimes when the dry days of summer hits, there's not much water there anymore.
So I'm looking at it to see, because I know it's in Europe, they're doing a lot of this.
Oh, you must be exploring a lot of possibilities every day, really.
Yeah.
Surfing the internet, so to speak.
Make
a lot of phone calls to other cities that you hear about that are doing this and that.
Yeah, the context, I'm talking to a company in Singapore right now that's doing waste to energy because they have no place to put their waste. So they build these plants. It's an American company. They're building waste energy plants. When our RFP went out to our request proposals, they contacted me.
In terms of
no, it's just
go ahead, Amy.
Thinking that granted, there's not necessarily a federal standard yet, but that the federal government must look at these local governments as guidelines. What's successful? That there's this generation of innovation happening at a local level that would be used as a guideline for the federal government. Do you see that happening?
Yes.
It just seems like more things happen at a local level.
I'm contacted weekly by the Department of Energy about different things that are going on. I have to give credit to the Department of Energy. They're not just, I know they're a huge bureaucracy, but how they've interacted with me in the city with the Energy Block Grant has been fabulous, very helpful. They give me so much information about different things going around the country. They are looking to the local governments to solve some of these energy problems because we're the ones who touch the people and interact with the businesses.
Plus, you made a good point earlier. I mean, each city would be, as far as federal guidelines, that's fine. But how they get there, each city would be unique in the sense that, well, we're on the water. We can utilize this particular technology, and other cities may not be able to. So it's good that they would treat it on an individual level. But your office isn't just about awareness. It sounds like you're actively – I mean, this is a very progressive office. I sound surprised, and I'm sorry. But I didn't realize that to the degree that you were doing these fast-forward thinking.
How big is your staff, Dave?
My staff is me.
That's what I thought.
And I have an intern. I started out with zero budget and have worked with the grants, and we just got another grant. It's a pollution prevention grant from the State Michigan Department of Resources, Natural Resources and Energy, to do a climate action plan. And I've just partnered with a lot of organizations who are doing in-kind contributions. It's the Clean Energy Coalition at Ypsilanti, the United States Green Building Council, their lead neighborhood development subcommittee. The Michigan State University Land Policy Institute is going to help us out. So I've had to build these partnerships, and to get things done.
You started from scratch, yeah.
Pretty much.
There's a very active group that we get press releases from, and we've talked to some of the people out there, too, in Ann Arbor, the Ecology Center. Mm-hmm. I think they have a Detroit office, too, or Detroit branch. I'm not sure whether that's functioning or not, but they deal with issues. Most recently, one thing they're doing is still fighting the coal plants, the installation of coal plants, because coal plants apparently are not as clean. That clean coal is either a misnomer or it's way in the future, that there's still all kinds of energy and ecology problems with even a modern coal-fired plant, although that's what's happening. DTE primarily uses for this area. It's coal-fired.
Yeah, that's the majority of our power. We get some from Fermi, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some atomic energy.
Yes.
Whoop-de-doo. Because I saw you write in, Dave not only talks the talk, but he walks the walk, or he bikes the bike path. He arrived here at WHFR on his bicycle and nearly rode over him on my way in my big high-powered car. No, it gets 30 miles to a gallon on the highway. Yes, it does. But you were saying that on Fridays, I guess the city, it's casual Friday. Is that typical?
The mayor instituted that, yes.
You can come in casual clothes, which would be more appropriate to bicycling and so on. And you're to be commended by setting that example.
Especially today. Nice job.
It's a little warm today.
You know, it's hard to do the right thing every day in terms of sustainability in our own individual lives. But if we can all just make a start and think about the amount we use our cars, or if we need a new car, what should we choose, or do we really need a car, or riding the bus, if there is one, once a day. Thank goodness the smart buses were reinstated, at least. It's a great temporary fix for people that don't have access to the other bus lines or easily have access. I have in if anyone listening is an alumnus of the University of Michigan, take a look in your alumni magazine. It's called Michigan Alumnus. The early fall 2010 issue has a lot of articles about fostering a culture of sustainability. And, of course, they want to promote the fact for alumni that they have at least seven groups on campus that's overseeing. They do have an office of campus sustainability and student sustainability initiative and Center for Sustainable Systems, which is all good. But they also have a list here, and I sort of like maybe you have some comments, too. Your office is not directly involved with setting up guidelines for individuals. So let me just go back. What about bike paths? Why can't we have bike paths on Michigan Avenue or other places where bicyclists don't have to depend on the sidewalks, because they always come to a curb? I know Dearborn mostly has the up-down curbs, but bike paths would allow people to go to work much more easily and actually at a faster speed and a straighter path and so on. And it is allowable technically on Michigan Avenue. I mean, by state law, you can bike on the far right of the right lanes.
Correct.
But it's a little scary, and a lot of motorists are, if there's not a bike path lane there, motorists won't really, they don't really want you there. What are you doing there? You know, just talk about bikes for a second. I talk about it with every city official, and usually get the same.
I'm glad you are bringing it up, because the pollution prevention grant we got, part of our climate action plan, is bike paths. We're looking at having SEMCOG does a bikeability audit. They'll come to our community and talk about what needs to be done. My goal is to put a framework in place that whenever we do a public infrastructure project that touches a road, to build in bikeability into that project.
Like the new train station.
Yes.
Which is going to be in West Dearborn. But
the new train station is, that's a good example.
$26 million here. They could put some discussion of bike paths, or at least bicycle racks, you know, or something where you could park your bike.
That will definitely be part of that structure, because it's going to be LEED certified, which is, you know, part of the United States Green Building Council, a green building standard. It's going to have bikeability will be part of that. Actually, I'm right now in the middle of writing a grant to figure out how to take that further out away from just the train station, to create a transit-oriented development in that whole area that includes biking and pedestrian.
In the second half of the show, we'll mention the news article this week about the Greenway initiatives, but that's been going on for quite a few years, and it doesn't mention anything in there about bicycles for transportation, for public transit, to get quickly from one place to another, either to your work or to shopping even. And of course, Fairlane Town Center, if they want a little business boost, you'd think that they would want to work on plans for getting sidewalks, at least, if not bike paths, all around them to connect with community. Right now, there really isn't any. It's very hazardous on peak times riding down, certainly Evergreen Road as well as Hubbard Drive on the north side here. And you came down Hubbard, and you know what it's like today. I usually do it when I come in on Sunday to do work. It's not quite as bad in terms of the traffic then. Well, you're aware of that. We said it here, and we want to support that any way we can.
You had said, well, Jay actually had said that you walk the walk. And when Amy had asked you earlier if you knew of anybody off the grid in this area, you said no. Mm-hmm. But then you started to talk about a little about something that you're doing with your family. Building something in Wisconsin. I was just wondering.
Sure, I could touch upon it. I have a family farm that's been 95 years now in central Wisconsin. And my brothers and I wanted to do something kind of outrageous and kind of honor my great-grandfather, and who had horses up until for a long period of time in the 50s. But we've decided to build a log cabin to be off the grid. And we've cut our own timber, selective cut our timber, and we stripped it, and we started building a log cabin that's going to be off the grid. We're going to have our pumps for our water is going to be solar powered. We're not going to have TV because there's no TV up there.
Right.
Always put a satellite
dish. Another positive.
Right. We don't want TV. We don't want anybody in the house. All right. My kids and my niece and nephew. We don't want to get outside.
No internet connection?
No. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful
thing.
Sure,
it'll be Wi-Fi.
No phone. There's no phone there. Nothing.
Can you hear me now? No, can't hear you now.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, you'll be off the grid.
We're off the grid. We're going to grow our own food. I do enjoy the outdoors. I hunt a little bit, and so we're going to.
How often do you think you'll spend time there?
Well, I spend about not quite a month there a year now.
Oh, okay.
I like to retire there.
Oh, okay. So that's a lifestyle that you're looking at?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Interesting.
Yes.
Well, that's of course. That's what sustainability originally was. Everybody would have their own farms, and this is more than 100 years ago, but you didn't have electricity, and so you had to make sure you had the right water, and you had to get the food in somehow. And, of course, if you live in a more densely populated area, even a small town or village or whatever, then you have to collectively work on those issues of water and food transport and so on. But you can still live sustainably, and we know it's possible because we used to be that way. You know, everybody had to be that way, and we still can be that way, even with relatively large cities, as long as we plan for it and reorganize our lives. Well, it's an exciting future, and Dave, we really appreciate your coming by and introducing yourself to our listeners here on the new WHFR Journal. This program, of course, is available as a download. It's archived at WHFR.fm. So, folks, if you're interested in what Dave said, you can tell them to listen to the journal all over again. Today's date, of course, of the 13th. We want to mention here, and we'll mention again and be promoting it more on WHFR, that the Sustainability Roundtable number 2, which was set up and begun by the Sierra Club Michigan office, is going to be happening at the University of Michigan Dearborn campus at the Environmental Interpretive Center that we mentioned earlier on Wednesday, August 25th, just a couple of weeks from next Wednesday, from 6 to 9, and you're going to be the featured speaker.
Mm-hmm. I will be
or defender of what's happening in Dearborn. You're going to be explaining the local initiatives. And it says here in the press release, including some of the awesome things made possible by the Federal Energy Efficiency Grants that we're already using. And included is, get this, folks, a tour of Mushroom Farm. The Mushroom Farm at the EIC.
Well, there you go. And that is open to the public, I think.
Yeah, it is, of course. Cool. And there's no charge for that. So we look forward to it says it's free. You can. They do have an RSVP to someone here, maturtle@gmail.com. That's what it says, maturtle, maturtle@gmail.com. If it's RSVP, it's probably just so they have sustainable cookies for people to eat or whatever.
They did. They had refreshments at the first one.
Enough chairs set up. But
yeah.
We look forward to that. Dave Norwood, Sustainability Coordinator of the City of Dearborn, thank you very much for coming here on the new WHFR Journal. And we hope to keep in touch and find out more projects that are going on and more things that we can help inform people about and support.
Appreciate that. Anytime you want me, I'll be happy to come on with you guys.
Okay, or send your intern. All right. Here's Jim Hightower.
Time. Let's see if we can handle this little lesson in logic. One, America has a rather huge child obesity problem. Two, major food corporations constantly pitch ads to children for such stuff as sugar-saturated breakfast cereals and fat-laden Happy Meals. So, how does fact number two relate to fact number one? Yes, number two is a cause of number one. It's really not that hard to grasp, is it? Unless you're a lobbyist for a food manufacturer. Last year, Congress directed four federal agencies to work together on new standards for ads that food giants run on cartoon shows and other TV programs for kids. This intervention was necessary because the industry's own voluntary program to push healthy choices for kids was, at best, loosey-goosey. For example, such sugar bombs as Kellogg's Fruit Loops and Frosted Flakes were nutritionally A-OK by industry standards, as was a candy named Yogos, the main ingredient of which is sugar. So, the agencies came up with nutritional requirements that were at least strict enough to prevent the marketing of candy as a health food. Ah, progress. But, oh mercy, the howls of pain from industry lobbyists was piercing. One shrieked that the new proposal, quote, would virtually end all food advertising as it's currently carried out to kids. No, sir. Not all food advertising, just ads for stuff like, well, Yogos. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, the screams of the food giants, echoed by their congressional puppets, seem to have spooked the agencies. The final proposal has now been delayed, and regulators have retreated to, quote, tweak it. Note that the main ingredient in the word tweak is weak. To help fight for strong nutritional standards, contact the Center for Science and the Public Interest. They're at cspinet.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
The summer doldrums are upon us, bringing searing heat and energy-sapping humidity. So naturally, people all across our sweltering nation are thinking of only one thing, Christmas. Say what? Yes, Santa in summer. Several big retail chains, desperate to lure economically depressed shoppers into their struggling outlets, hit upon the brilliant idea last month of convincing customers that they should rush to the mall in the heat of summer to get a jump on their Christmas shopping. I'm assuming that someone left these marketing geniuses out in the sun too long, shriveling their brains down to the size of a dried fig. Nonetheless, Target, Toys R Us, and Sears are among the slap-happy giants that have recently been stringing up lights, hanging sparkly ornaments, and blaring out Christmassy tunes over their store speakers in an all-out effort to push the summer Christmas theme. We really wanted to create that sense of excitement, that sense of urgency, gushed Target's spokeswoman, sounding slightly panicky, not to mention nuttier than a fruitcake. For America's middle-class families these days, income is down, firings are common, jobs are scarce, and expenses keep rising, including for back-to-school purchases they'll soon have to make. So how much ho-ho-ho and buy-buy-buy do these retailers think people have in them? Indeed, JCPenney is among the big merchants taking a pass on the forced merriment of this off-season. Customers don't like it when you push Christmas too early, a top Penney's executive told the Associated Press. You don't have to be a Scrooge to recognize reality. It's too hot to think about Christmas, one shopper told an AP reporter. Another was more pointed. I just got laid off, she said. This is Jim Hightower saying, retail giants should listen to common sense and give consumers some breathing room. Christmas has already been made way too commercial in its own season. Why rush it?
And we're back with more of the new WHFR Journal here. Thanks to Dave Norwood from the City of Dearborn, Sustainability Coordinator, for coming by for the first half hour. Wanted to continue in that vein with the list of from the U of M alumnus magazine, Michigan alumnus, how you can live more sustainably. It says, while one person can't solve the world's environmental problems, everyone can make some contribution. The following are a few suggestions that they make for changes that you can make. So we got eight of them here. Pencil and paper handy? Okay, number one.
And you
one.
Can always come up with your own.
Of course, there's many more.
That's
many
right.
more. Every day in every way we should consider how to do it in a more efficient manner. Less energy. Hey, less means physically we don't get as tired and as fatigued if we can figure out a way to personally, let's say, have fewer trips to the store. Or there's all kinds of ways that we can do it in our own personal lives. But the top eight here that they suggest, and some are little haven't heard it before. Number one, use a low flow shower head to save as much as 350 pounds of carbon dioxide per year. That just reduces the amount of water that comes out of your shower head. And these low flow heads, they turn into a little tighter mist and spray, I know. And you wouldn't even notice you don't have as much water. People say, well, I got to have water to rinse the soap off. You don't need as much as actually is coming out of the old fashioned shower
right.
heads. And so they cost maybe $20 at most, $30 if you want to get the shiny chrome version. And it's easy to screw on and screw off. Make sure you do it with one of those little bits of plastic tape that they include so that it doesn't leak and spray out of the back as well as the front. But it's relatively easy to put on yourself, a low-flow shower head. Of course, setting the temperature for water in the house to 120 degrees, which will really, you know, scald your skin anyway. You don't need the steam setting of 212 or even 140 or 150. That'll save you so much because water heaters, of course, are a big energy problem
for the
environment.
When you mention that, a safety factor for people with kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you
yeah.
want to set that lower so there's not those accidental issues.
Exactly. So yeah. that's their number one suggestion from the U of M. Number two, eat less meat.
I'm already there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you know, most doctors, even traditional doctors, say you shouldn't eat more than about 4 ounces of meat a day. And then the difference should be, yeah, some whole grains, of course, but a lot more vegetables and fruits than you normally would think of eating. That's the healthiest kind of diet, just not too much meat. And, okay, maybe leaner meat like chicken or turkey or fish. Fish can be eaten too, but a lot less meat. Maybe once a week, set a day when you don't eat meat at all. And that would help the environment so much. Well, first of all, meat is expensive, so it'll help your budget to not eat as much meat. But number two, you know, you can get the protein from beans and even eggs. I know that's dairy, but meat is very, not energy efficient to produce because the cattle, the chickens, and the turkeys and so on, it takes a lot of energy, if you will, to raise them and grow them and ship them after they're slaughtered. I'm sorry, a little vegetarian philosophy in my heart here. So a meat-based diet takes twice as much energy to produce as a vegetarian diet and has significant environmental impacts on land use, water use, and pollution and air emissions. You know, those animals, they produced methane for the environment from their wastes, and that's a hazard in the air.
If there was some way to capture that.
Well, and they've thought about that. Some
sure.
of these recycling centers for waste, if they can pull the methane gas
right.
out and redirect it, they can run buses on methane mm-hmm. and cars and so on. Right now, it's kind of expensive to do that, but it is a way to recycle that. One of the most effective environmental consumer choices, and this is according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, not just the American Vegetarian Society, is to eat less meat. It's mm-hmm. the number one best thing you can do for the environment. And probably for your health, too, because many kinds of meat have a lot of fat in them. But it helps the environment, actually. Eat less meat. Number three, use less refrigeration, which accounts for 13% of all energy consumed. Consider a smaller, more efficient refrigerator. Certainly get one of these smart energy refrigerator with a higher energy a higher insulation rating if you're going to be replacing refrigerator. But they say also buy smaller quantities of fresh produce more frequently. So you can maybe get a smaller size refrigerator
mm-hmm.
and just buy less produce more frequently, like at a farmer's market,
sure,
thereby getting locally grown products that are fresher and don't have to come thousands of miles. I mean, it always amazes me to see, and sometimes I fall victim to it. I buy fruits or vegetables from Peru or Guatemala or Mexico, and I'm, when you think about it, how the heck does it get here? Trains, planes, do they take buses? Cantaloupe taking buses? It's, you know, big time transport with burning all that energy, and yet the prices don't seem that high. So it means they're paying the people that harvest that, grow and harvest that stuff, almost nothing in Peru or Mexico or whatever. But then there's the energy cost of getting it here. So buy local, you know, support the Dearborn Farmers Market and the other permanent farmers markets that we have. We have two others in Dearborn, the Dearborn Farm Market and the Dearborn Farmers Market down on Monroe Street.
Dearborn Farm Market.
No, but what's the one on Michigan Avenue called?
The Farmers and Artisans Market.
No. That's the local one that.
You're talking about Westbourne?
Westbourne. There we go. Magic word. Yeah, Dearborn Farm Market, which is a permanent facility down on Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
The Westbourne Farm Market, which is a permanent facility on Michigan Avenue, because mm-hmm. they do have some local products and fresh things that come in to those facilities. And I guess you could go to the market in Detroit that is there, I think,
Eastern,
every Saturday morning.
Eastern Market,
yeah. Right, wonderful, every sure. Saturday morning. Although I've always found that they want you to buy in larger quantities, and a lot of the stuff I find there is on the edge of spoiling.
Oh, dear.
It's like, you know, you want to use it the next couple of days,
right.
Definitely. Whereas even the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market, that stuff will stay for a week or two. Thank you, Amy and Dennis. Both of you were there for the – Amy was for the farm
We were both
report.
Down there.
Oh, yeah.
There,
but they brought me a loaf of fresh bread since
just
I couldn't get
there.
And
that's how you know
morning.
We were
just
there.
Just semi-whipped up. Hope you like it.
Yeah. I forced them to do the report. And
that's how
I did pay them for the bread, though. Okay, but
– You know, not only the energy factor with buying your fruits and vegetables locally. It's a time factor that they're fresher. They last longer when you're buying local. So that's
absolutely.
The biggest thing on my mind when I'm buying local.
Point four, and I hadn't realized this, but if you add ceiling fans, and there are ceiling fans that don't just blow you to bits, you know, there's actually energy efficient ceiling fans you can get.
You gotta raise them above your head. Them
well, it's a question of the fan blade. It's a question of the design. It's a question of the low, the high efficiency electric motor
right.
in it. But if you add ceiling fans, especially the ones that are designed for energy efficiency, your air conditioning for your house, if you have central air, can be set about 5 degrees higher, and you won't notice.
You are absolutely right.
Okay.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of houses.
You'll save a ton of money on your air conditioning bill, and then the electric bill with these high-efficiency ceiling fans is going to be lower. You're going to save money and help the environment. Air conditioning is one of those things that is a big burden on our energy use in this country. We're used to it. Unfortunately, our houses and buildings are designed for central air,
right?
Not for energy efficiency airflow from one
cross
breeze.
Sure.
They're
right.
not designed for that. Maybe mm-hmm. some of the homes built back in the 20s here in Dearborn, Ford Homes District in West Dearborn, those homes were designed for that. But today, everybody's kind of used to central air. But you don't need to set the air conditioner so high if you have good ceiling fans. And the trade-off is energy efficiency, energy savings. Number 5 point here on my 8-point list from U of M Ann Arbor, convert appliances from electric to natural gas. I know electricity seems cleaner and simpler, and there is a some people's mind, and it's certainly true, there is a fire or explosion hazard potential with gas appliances or gas furnaces. But if you already have gas lines to your house, having a natural gas clothes dryer and natural gas to cook with, again, the modern units are very cool, very nice, very energy efficient. Natural gas is a good temporary answer, and it's more cost-effective than electricity. Again, reducing primary energy consumption by 75%.
Wow.
By using natural gas instead of electrical units. 6, select durable or renewable materials in your home, such as cork or hardwood floors rather than carpeting.
Hmm.
Okay.
Cork.
Yeah, cork. got to think about that. Yeah. I need to do something about the carpet in my sort of living room area. And hadn't thought about cork. Now, hardwood cost a fortune because it's real wood. Oh, right. My gosh. As our students know, returning to class this fall, that their real paper-based textbooks are costing $100 to $150 even for a paperback now, although I think somebody is making a profit on those specialized publications, and it's not the public, it's not the students. Number seven, as Dave Norwood did today, walk, bike, carpool, take mass transit, or drive a more fuel-efficient vehicle. That kind of transportation, absolutely essential. I know when I go shopping, as much as possible, I go on my bicycle. I have a backpack. I have a sort of a messenger bag that holds a lot. I just got, last time I had my bike in for a little tune-up at the store, I got a rear carrier. Okay. So I can actually use a bungee cord and put products and food bags on that now. I didn't have that before, and my messenger bag only holds so much. And point number eight here, just to finish this list off from U of M, set your computer monitor and hard drive to go to sleep after 15 minutes of not being used, and your whole system to go to standby mode after 30 minutes. And a lot of people just say, oh, I have a screensaver. But the energy of the computer is still being used. Even though your screensaver is burning away, your hard drive is still spinning. There are these tools in your in every computer, PC and Mac, that whether it's called energy saver or sleep mode or whatever, that you should find out how to do that and save on cost. And all it takes is just a second or two once you hit the keyboard when you come back to it, if you have to leave it on, to reboot everything or just to restart everything in the energy efficient mode. It starts up in just 2 or 3 seconds, the sleep mode, out of the sleep mode. And the standby mode takes not as much as a full boot up, even 30 seconds maybe. So those are a couple of ideas about how you can live more sustainably. We all have to do our part. If everybody would just make a slight change in their lifestyles and personal choices about energy efficiency and sustainability, boy. Everything would change so fast, but like everybody has to do it. You know, everybody's not going to start to do it. So maybe you could start to do it. Yes, you, loyal listener, and tell other people and say how proud you are or how easy it is to do. Spread the word and get other people helping out. I think it's essential for the future. If we just want to keep going the way we're going, we have to make these other choices. Well, we want to switch to some other news here going on. I had a couple things briefly I wanted to mention. I've been wanting to mention a couple of weeks about General Motors Volt. Mm-hmm. Even President Obama came to Michigan a couple of weeks ago to see the unveiling of the Chevy Volt, and you can actually place an order for that now. The problem is the car's retail price is $41,000. Now, there are some tax breaks, but it only takes about, I think, $6,000 off. They're supposedly offering a $350 a month lease deal over 36 months, which is similar to the Nissan Leaf automobile that I had. I told Mayor O'Reilly I had money down on a Leaf, but unfortunately won't be coming to Michigan until the end of 2011. And my current lease car, that lease is up at the end of this year, and I just couldn't wait. So I'm not going to get a Nissan Leaf, and so Mayor O'Reilly would be happy about that.
We're all happy about that.
Okay.
Well, just a couple people at Nissan
aren't. No, yippity-doo-dah.
Yeah. Totally, solidly behind electric cars as the best thing to do for people like myself that drive very few miles and only around town each week. Although a lot of things are so close to my house in Dearborn, I can just bicycle there. So.
Maybe a golf cart could tide you over.
Well, a neighborhood vehicle would work in Dearborn, mm-hmm. except they cost about $10,000 or $15,000. One of my colleagues here in the fine arts area, he's been driving an electric car, a neighborhood electric car, mm-hmm. a gem that Chrysler makes. They call it a gem. Yeah. From Royal Oak to the college. It's a 40-45 minute trip, but he gets here in the same time as if he had a big time car because he has to go like Evergreen all the way from Royal Oak down to Dearborn.
Oh,
he
no
can't
kidding.
Be on Southfield Expressway with
right.
it. It's not legal for that speed because it can't go tops that speed.
Tops out at about
it tops
25?
Out, no, 35.
35, okay.
Yeah. But that's still a neighborhood vehicle, and you can buy them. He had to go to, I think, Brighton
mm-hmm.
or Milford or somewhere to get one.
Okay.
And then he had to get it shipped down here somehow. To his house in Royal
Those
Oak.
Those are becoming more popular. You know, the reconditioned models will be cheaper.
There we go.
Yeah, and of course you can get hybrids. The Toyota Prius has been out there for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm against that for a number of reasons I won't go into now. I'm really a car nut, folks. I really know a lot about cars, and I won't bore you. But I saw here a story just a couple days ago is that a dealer in California is telling people, yeah, they can order it, but, you know, since they're in limited availability, the starting price will be $61,000.
Oh, come on. Prius?
That's price. No, this is for the Volt.
Oh.
GM Volt.
Oh, dear.
That is price gouging, folks. And this is one reason that local dealers, I don't like a lot of U.S. local dealers. They are not customer savvy, and they can do things from one dealer to another, like different prices. So you go to one dealer to get a price even on a Ford, and you go to another dealer a couple miles away and get a different price on the same exact car. Now, one is lower, perhaps, so if you go to all the trouble and waste all that energy of going all around, then you get different prices. Now, GM Saturn, which is gone now, which they've killed, they had only one price.
Right.
And every Saturn dealer would sell you the same car at the same price. BMW. One price. They negotiate a little, a couple hundred bucks now from one dealer to another. But
you want the undercoating.
But I do not know why the car manufacturers, the U.S. dealers, why don't they just get their own dealers, okay, and operate them? It could be at a lower price because they don't have to. I mean, they have the markup they get from selling, from making the car, and they sell it to the dealer. But then they could sell it at very little price if it's the deal. I mean, the dealer-owned dealers, I mean, the manufacturer-owned dealers could theoretically undercut the price of all the other dealers if they wanted to. And of course, the other dealers, well, that's not fair. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of irregularities and price gouging on the part of some dealers, and not talking about their service departments either. Which and the car manufacturers I know, Ford and Chrysler and GM, the U.S.-based companies, and there aren't many of them left, are they're really very upset with the dealer networks. It's hard to get them organized. It's hard to get them to be equally fair and responsible to the U.S. customer. And that's one of the reasons, folks, that the Japanese cars have moved into this country so far, is that they have somewhat consistent pricing and great customer service and knowledgeable salespeople.
And rarely a union.
Yeah. And so General Motors, you know, they're, and the U.S. government, which still owns 60% of GM, they're going to try to stop that price gouging, they said in the article, the New York Times this week, and to get that dealer to change their situation so that their cars can be competitive to the Nissan Leaf and other Ford Focus 2012, maybe in early 2012, there'll be an electric Ford Focus that should be here, even in Michigan, And can't do this kind of price gouging and stay competitive with the Japanese, for example. And I've heard of no price gouging on very set, consistent prices on the Leaf, which is only going to cost about $31,000. And although the Volt, yes, does have a gasoline engine, and so if you run out of battery power, you can go maybe another 300 miles on their wimpy little four-cylinder that's in that car.
Well, that's significant.
Yes, it is. A lot of people
want that,
would like that kind of thing.
Want that
this
backup.
Is a plug-in hybrid, that the Volt is the first plug-in hybrid. Supposedly Toyota will have one. And all together, if you do city driving and expressway driving together, you might get over 100 miles to a gallon because you don't use gas for the first 40 miles or so. You just use the batteries. And then the gasoline engine kicks in to recharge the batteries a little bit, but also drive the car. So these plug-in hybrids, and that's really worthy of your attention, folks, whether it's the Volt or the Toyota plug-in Prius in 2 years, will give you equivalent of about 150 miles to a gallon, is what they're thinking of, and maybe 200 miles to a gallon in a couple years. So it's worthwhile considering. I think other things like safety and comfort and handling are all factors that a lot of people don't even know the difference of right now, and I won't get into it here. But I wish you know, good success to GM and their Volt and all the other cars coming online that are part of this more sustainable future. Some of them are not well designed, and some of them don't go far enough yet. In 2 years, we should have a lot of really good
point.
Choices that are very, very price competitive to the other cars on the market.
This is trial and error time, right?
Yeah, it's exciting, but people got to educate themselves and learn about things. I don't know if we want to reflect about the news of the day. We're almost at the conclusion of our time. We got a couple minutes more before 1 o'clock. Our podcast for the show always continues to 2:02, 2 o'clock, of course. Yeah, what time is it here? And we're waiting for the return from her Mississippi Blues Convention Festival of Joanne Korczynska for the Blues Show. So just and stop me if you wave your hand at me, Amy or Dennis, you want to talk about these things here. I really recommend that people read, and I can't go over it now, Tom Watkins from the Press and Guide last Sunday. That's August 8th. He's got an editorial opinion, very long statement about we need a certain kind of leader as the next Michigan governor, and he doesn't mention names there. But it's a very good outline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Jack Lessenberry in this week's Metro Times, again, an editorial that we can't treat in detail, about how he sees the coming competition between Bonnero and Snyder for Michigan governor. And we're going to try to get in touch with, on this show, alternative, that is third-party candidates for governor, and just what third parties are talking about in Michigan. They will be on the ballot.
And actually, we have lined up for September 10th, Green Party gubernatorial candidate Harley Mickelson.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
He should know something about sustainability, right?
I would hope so.
I think it's like the number one idea of their whole political platform. Well, of course,
maybe their time has come.
The Green Party also has many social justice issues,
too. That's right, absolutely.
We're going to be concluding here, and Highway 61 is going to start in just a few moments on WHFR Dearborn. Dennis?
Well, as we're winding down, I just want to say thank you to all the great people that came out to see us at homecoming.
Oh, fantastic weekend.
I met a lot of listeners, and just the support for the station is just, I don't know, it's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, we're very grateful for that.
Yes.
And finally, I just wanted to commend the University of Michigan. My alumni status kicks in here. My master's degree was from U of M. My bachelor's was from Oakland University. And all right. They're a great place
it's
in Rochester,
good.
Too. Mm-hmm. It's all good. It's all good. Good education is all
right?
good.
Yes.
But the University of Michigan just won the national competition for the solar car race. This was as fast as you can go, powered by the sun, and it was from like Nebraska to Indiana.
How cool.
It's
and
very cool.
They won for the third year in a row.
Congratulations.
That's a compliment to all the students out there and their technology programs and their solar energy programs. They won third year in a row. And that car, of course, very small, very lightweight, but it has to be big enough to have solar panels
mm-hmm.
on it, you know.
Sure.
Over 100 miles an hour at times.
Really?
So don't
Amazing.
Think that electric cars can't go fast.
Right.
This was, a bare-bone structure, so they could go as far as possible on a charge. And they had to do little repairs. They had a Black Widow spider that got into their battery compartment.
Really?
And
oh, dear.
Had to be removed with the very long pliers at a certain point.
Or a lot
point.
Of rage.
Spider
imagine,
power.
Imagine the driver there is looking at his batteries somehow in the rearview mirror. Oh, my God, it's a spider. And you remember... Objects may appear closer in your rearview mirror.
And larger.
So, larger.
No, it says they are larger than they are.
He has to get on his walkie-talkie. I got us. Putting a monster spider attacking me. And all the fun of that race, but they won the third year in a row. And so Michigan technology, and hopefully we'll be in the forefront in other areas, too, in the future.
That's awesome. Don't you think that's Jay's first question when he looks at these cars? So how fast does it go?
I'm sure it is.
No, that's fine. It's good price, and it's safe, but how fast does it go?
I think performance and handling is something that is a safety factor.
Absolutely.
At least the way I drive.
I was going to say.
Yeah. And I got to have it. I know that.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thanks, Amy and Dennis, and thanks to Dave Norwood for coming by today. The new WHFR Journal is going to conclude, and on to Highway 61, the best in the blues with Joanne K. Coming right up now, WHFR Dearborn Station, making waves.